for listening to episode 343 of the New World Order. My name is Cloud 2, and in this episode, we're going to talk about software licensing. First off, this is in response, technically, to some listener email. Yeah, feedback, whatever. This is from Kevin. I'm not going to read the email, because it's gone beyond the email now. But this is Kevin, who was talking about software licensing a couple episodes ago, actually. And he emailed me some further thoughts about that, and I didn't respond. And then he sort of poked me and was like, hey, you didn't respond to that thing. So I originally didn't think I had anything to say. And then I started typing a response, because he asked me for a response. And I realized, actually, I did have some things to say. And let me start by saying, I am not here to praise proprietary software, but to bury it. By which I mean, the term proprietary has become one of those tags that we humans invent, or develop, rather. We don't invent it, actually. We do definitely develop these tags for things, because we humans famously, everyone tells me this, humans love to classify things and group things together and so on. I get that. So we very frequently come up with these labels, and we don't, unfortunately, invent new words for these labels. I mean, sometimes we kind of do. Sometimes I can't actually think of a for instance, but I do know that it's happened. We've invented words. I mean, I guess even sort of, isn't like cellular, is that a real word? Was that a word before cellular? I'm not sure. That could be a made-up word. I think a lot of our words tend to be sort of combinations of other words, or sometimes I guess we adapt really, really ancient words to be applicable now. I'm struggling to find a good example of this, but I'm belaboring the point now. Point being, we have these labels, and a lot of times we use a different term. We appropriate a word for it. And we have done this with the term proprietary. I guess, the answer to my question was staring right at my face. Open source is, you could argue that that's a made-up term for a label that is pretty specific. Obviously, it's not a made-up word. It's a combination of two words, open and source. But if we group those together and we say open source, and it's certainly in the context of software, then we can say, okay, this is a thing that we made up, and it's a label that we apply to things that meet this set of conditions. And that's good. And proprietary, we have this label, and it means, like, if you read a dictionary about what proprietary means, it means relating to ownership. That's what the word proprietary means. And so you can say, this is a proprietary design. My writing desk is a proprietary design, which would mean that you created it yourself. You built the thing yourself. You sketched it out and got the timber and did some cuts and drove some nails, and then you ended up with a table or a desk or whatever. And it's a proprietary design because you came up with it and you own that design. It's just kind of yours. It's something that you did. We apply it very frequently in the open source world to sort of, well, non-open, right? If it's not open, then it must be proprietary, right? That's kind of our, Aristotelian view of things, is that when you see everything, there's sort of two poles, right? There are these two extremes, and that's all that exists. There's no space between them. They're just right up against each other, and they are hard lines. That's how we very typically talk about proprietary software in the open source world. Of course, in the real world, which is kind of a funny thing, I realize, saying real world to differentiate it between the open source world is funny, because the open source world is the real world. Like, the real world got eaten, they say, by open source. So the real world is very much interested in open source. But in the real world, I think the normal computer users are a lot less interested in, well, is it open source or is it proprietary? It's more like, oh, I really like this thing that's happening. And then you say, hey, it's open source. And they say, oh, cool. And that's it. You know, that's their level of interest. There's not the division. But in the open source world, there is the division. There kind of has to be the division, right? Because you got to be careful out there in the open source real world. It's a dangerous landscape. You look at a nifty little library or application, and the next thing you know, you are using software that you or you're using some component, some asset that you are not allowed to then redistribute. And then where are you? Where's your project? Well, it is now sort of landlocked. You can't do anything with it. So it's something that we have to look out for realistically, because it will trick us. It will mess us up. So it's completely fair to make that differentiation. I'm just noticing that there is that differentiation. And I don't want there to be, I think that we all ought to be aware of this, of the fact that it is just a label. It is a thing that we apply partly as a warning to ourselves and partly as a warning to others that, hey, this thing is owned by someone else. And even if you download it and put it on your computer, and even if you throw money at it, you don't own that. You have to understand that is not something that you own. If someone wants to take it away from you, they have it in their EULA right here, a clause that they can do that, that they can take that away. And we see it in real life. It happens all the time. We all have a story. Well, maybe not we all, but many people have stories of that one favorite killer app that they had, and they just needed to have that app. And then the big evil corporation stopped making it. What do people do? Well, typically, we adapt. We were using the thing. We insisted we could not live without. We refused to switch to open source because, remember, can't live without the thing. And then the thing goes away because the company took it away. And then we found something different. And, of course, as we open source enthusiasts will say, you know, you can avoid that condition by switching to open source before the thing gets taken away from you, or gets changed irrevocably out from under you. People don't seem to listen to that all the time, and it's frustrating, and it's a thing that sort of makes us very annoyed at the proprietary software world, because it's the thing, and there's the threat of being taken away. We offer an alternative, people insist that the alternative's not good enough, and then the thing gets taken away, and they find a different alternative. They insisted they couldn't do with an alternative. No alternative was good enough. But now they've got the alternative because the thing got taken away, and they just didn't listen to us. It's a little bit, I guess, like when you tell someone you love, you know, a family member, about something that you think would be really good for them. You know, you should get this, you should invest in this, some stock in this company, because their prices are going to just blow up in the next year, and you'll be rich. And the person doesn't listen to you, and you say, look, I'm a stock trader by trade. This is what I do. You should listen to me. They won't listen to you. And then, you know, last minute, someone, a TV show tells them that they should invest in this stock. And so they do, and then they get a lot of money, and they say, good thing I listened to that TV show. And you're sitting there thinking, I told them that like a year ago. I don't know why that's the example that came to my head. It's all very, actually, very, very imaginary, but that's a good enough illustration, right? So anyway, as I was saying, proprietary software, it's a label, it's a thing that we have to be aware of. Problems start to arise, though, when that term, the proprietary term, either gets used in other ways, or when we realize that it had implications and meanings before we started making it the label for something specific in the software world. It's honestly one of the several reasons that I tend to prefer the term non-open source or closed source, something like that. There are two reasons for that. One, because it avoids the term proprietary, which I don't believe is super accurate, and I'm going to get to why I think that in a moment. And then two, because it brings attention to the fact that the alternative is open source. So because if you're saying proprietary, that doesn't necessarily convey anything other than someone owns it. But to most computer users, everything is owned, right? I mean, nothing is without an owner. So what's the big deal about proprietary? I don't understand. Whereas if you sort of talk about it in as a thing that is not open source, then that brings attention to the fact, well, the obvious alternative to not being open is to be open. And doesn't that sound nice? And it typically does sound nice. Whether or not they're going to actually adopt it or not is a completely different question. I'm just saying that proprietary seems like a throwaway term, right? We throw that away when we say it. It has other meanings, and furthermore, people don't understand what we mean, and then we're not getting any points. We're not getting a mention of open source in there because we're just talking about proprietary software and how it's not very good. So it's just, to me, it's an ineffective term. And it's made even, I think, less effective when you realize we all essentially have proprietary software in our lives, on our computers right now. You have it. Look on your hard drive, look in your home directory. There's proprietary software there. And you're thinking, but Klaatu, I don't. I run Linux and this is fine. And maybe I've even got the Libre kernel, so there's no firmware blobs lurking on my motherboard. And I got a Purism laptop, so there's no, there, all the chips are open source, or I don't even know if that's true, but I mean, we all hear about the dangers of secret, forbidden, proprietary stuff lurking in the depths of our computer, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm actually just talking about the stuff that you use on an everyday basis, like just the stuff that you generate, essentially user data, right? Like there's a script on my hard drive right now, probably, called FIT, FIT, and it's a little script that I use to crop PNGs and JPEGs down to a certain size for a website that I contribute to sometimes, and I think it shrinks it down and adds some metadata, and that's all it does. And it's a little script, and I've never published it online. It is proprietary software. I own it. I've never shared it with anyone. That's actually not true. I've shared it with someone, but pretend like I haven't owned it. I mean, there are other scripts, not that one, that I have not shared with anyone because they're just my scripts. They're just things that I use on an everyday basis that I don't think about. It's not a big open source project that I'm creating. It's something that is probably redundant to most other Linux users who have the same workflow as me. I don't know how many of those there are, but they're little things. They're just throwaway scripts that you write because after 10 times of doing something, you think, no. This needs to be automated, or worse, this needs to be scripted. Probably it's not automation, but yeah, this needs to be scripted. And so you script it. It takes like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, okay, an hour after you debug it, and then you never have to do those 10 steps again. You just run that script, and you never think, oh, I need to publish it. I need to put a license on this and publish it online quick, because otherwise, I've got proprietary software on my laptop. That's not how that works. This is the dream of Unix, right? This is exactly what Unix wanted to have happen. People should be writing their own software on a daily basis. People should be able to use components from the system, piece them together for bigger results. And while it may be useful, maybe, for people to post every single little tiny script that they write for themselves, and every little configuration file that they ever generate, and so on, online for other users, after a certain point, we could imagine that that would become information overload. There would be so many different ways to remove a space from a file name, for example, or so many ways to rename a file in bulk. So many ways to crop JPEGs and PNGs, so many ways to desaturate a picture and make it black and white, so many ways to do all of these little tasks that maybe me and maybe not you, but that person, and then not those people, but that person, we automated it. We've got it for ourselves. It works for us. Maybe we're piping in some weird information maybe I'm typing in some weird information that that person doesn't need, so their version of this obvious and redundant task is a little bit different from mine, and so on. So in other words, this is what Linux should be, is a bunch of people with their custom workflows on their computers that work really, really well for them. And there shouldn't be sort of this weird obligation of, well, I've got to share this now, or else I'm falling prey to the evils of proprietaryism, because that's just not a real, that's not how it works. And that's not how it should work. It should not work any other way. It shouldn't be that if you don't open your computer to everyone for all to see, you're being a bad person and you're being greedy and you're not sharing the code. That's just not, that isn't the point. And I don't think that's ever been the point of free software. So that relates to Kevin in the remember Kevin? He was the guy who sent me an email, and technically I'm responding to it. That relates to him in this way. He is releasing some sort of operating system or environment or something like that, and he is hoping to provide support for his users. And the support that he is providing, the system by which he is providing support, will functionally be proprietary software. Right, it's his home sort of brewed, homespun, homebrewed. What's the word? Is custom-made infrastructure to ensure that his customers can access support and probably, I imagine, file support tickets and that he can track them and so on. And I feel like if you are the owner of the problem and you've got some system that you have created to solve that problem, I don't feel like we're crossing into the realm of, like, you know, open source versus proprietary. Maybe we are. Maybe you could argue that we were. Maybe you think, well, Klaatu, that's awfully short-sighted, because today it's just Kevin, but tomorrow it's going to be Kevin and his multi-million dollar business with the software code that he wrote and isn't sharing with the world. And that, if anything, surely would be classified as non-open or proprietary. And I can see that. I can see that sort of dangerous eventuality of, we've given someone an inch and they've taken several miles, and they've created this big evil proprietary thing that is going to take over Linux. But I do feel like probably we all kind of have to sit and sort of ponder for ourselves the tool set that we are using, and whether or not we want that tool set to become a major open source project where people will contribute, and that you would even accept merges too. I mean, in Kevin's case, and again, I don't know Kevin's actual use case, I don't know his intentions, but in Kevin's case, I mean, so he has this software that he's offering support, that he uses to track support tasks. Great. He puts it online as an open source thing. Is he going to get actual contributors? Does he want users? Is that one of his goals? Does he want people to contribute and use the software? Or is this truly just for himself? And is there anything wrong about developing software for yourself? I really don't think so. And I don't think most people in open source would say that was a wrong or bad thing. I do think that we are a little bit hesitant to embrace that idea when it's put into those terms. I mean, it sounds like a classic, like, sort of evil creep, right? I mean, like, oh sure, we let this happen today for this one person, but just wait, in 6 years it's going to be Google all over again. It's going to be MongoDB all over again. It's going to be Microsoft. It's going to be, you know, all the people who've extended and embraced this thing and then later snuff it out. But we have to temper that with just pragmatism, I think. And I, believe me, I'm not saying we need to temper our use of closed source software with pragmatism. And, you know, if you have to use Photoshop or SketchUp or AutoCAD or Maya, or I don't know, I'm just trying to think, oh, Microsoft Office, that's a big one, then go for it, because it's just a pragmatic thing to do. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not on that level of pragmatism at all. I'm simply saying that at some point, there's just real life single computer user usage. And at some point, you design systems that work for yourself, and you're not obligated to share those. And that's fine. And I think it's almost probably better not to share than to share and ignore. So in other words, I think probably, in theory, Kevin could probably, if he published his source code for his little support thing or whatever he's got going on, I think he could probably get some help. Like, he could probably, if he wanted to expend the energy to publicize it and to attract people to the project and then to get merge requests or patches or whatever, he might learn something new. Other people might learn from him, but realistically, that's not his goal. His goal is to accomplish a very specific task. And it's his task. It is his work. It is his job, his self-provided job. And that doesn't have to be open. It doesn't have to be closed. It's proprietary. And in a weird way, that's the most Linux thing he could do. Hopefully for you, I've got mine, and some, I don't know if you can hear it, but some lawn work, apparently. The neighbor, while I was going to go get my coffee, the neighbor fired up some kind of lawn trimming tool, so hopefully it's not too loud in your audio. It is right in my ear. It sounds like he's right outside my window, but he's actually not. Anyway, in this segment, I wanted to talk about something that I've mentioned before, but just recently I kind of had reinforced. And that topic is the example that Linux has, as it turns out, set for a lot of other major players in the computing world. For instance, there are, I mean, this is the thing that made me think of all of this. There are things out there right now that you can download on Windows and Mac that will provide you a package manager. Like, not something like a package manager, a package manager. One is called Brew, or Homebrew rather, and you can find it at something like brew.sh, I think is the website, the URL. And the other one is chocolaty.org. That is Chocolaty, Choc, Olatey.org, and that's the one for Windows. And they provide a through a terminal of some sort, whether it's the non-open source terminal interface of the Mac OS Mac operating system, or the iTerm 2 open source interface for the same operating system, or PowerShell, the believe it or not, open source interface for Windows. You type in things like brew install foo, and it pulls down a script to build foo and processes it and installs it on your system. And then do the same for bar. And then when you want to update both, you can do brew updates, I guess. I'm a little bit hazy on the syntax because I don't use it, but brew updates foo and bar, and it will update both of them, and so on. Same goes for Chocolaty. There's a command with Chocolaty. I believe it's Choco, if I'm recalling correctly, and it's the same kind of deal. You can install things, you can update them, you can keep them updated, you can look at the different options that they have and the different versions that they have online, and so on. And when I was looking at these two tools, I mean, it's not amazing that they exist. For instance, I don't know much about the Windows world, so I can't really comment on that. I know that there's Cygwin and things like that. I don't know what kind of amenities that offered in the time that it was more relevant, I guess, than it is now. Not that it's not relevant now. I'm just saying there's other stuff out there now with Cygwin, and before on Mac OS, you had things like Fink Project and Mac Ports. Both of which I did episodes on here on this show, actually, a long, long time ago, back in season zero, I think, or maybe one a little bit. I talked about both of those projects, and that was like back in 2008, I want to say. So that they've been around. The concept is not new, but I think the popularity of these two projects, specifically Brew and Chocolaty, I think is really kind of surprising. It's pronounced, it's noticeable. Now, granted, I'm looking at it through a lens of computer geekery that a lot of people do not look at it. And so, if I stepped outside the house right now and just went to some random person on the street and said, "Hey, do you use Brew or Chocolaty? Chocolaty, Choco?" They would not know what I'm talking about. They would look at me like I was talking about a variety of drinks. So I don't expect, I don't believe that they're that popular, that big of a deal. On the other hand, they are a big enough deal that they've made an impression on at least the developer world. And they've made an impression on the developer world in a way that I don't think it is less easy to ignore now than it used to be. Like if Chocolaty had existed 5 years ago, I think it would have fallen flat. And frankly, if Brew had list had gotten started 10 years ago, it probably would have fallen flat because there are other things out there that were like it enough, and there was no real point to it. So the fact that it's kind of hit now can partly be chalked up to just kind of general fad, right? It's kind of, there's some group out there who thought for whatever reason there needed to be a new package manager for certainly Mac OS. Why they thought that, I don't know. There's MAC ports, I think that's still around. There is a package source from NetBSD, so that would still work. I'm not sure if NixOS, or rather Nix, the package manager, works on Mac, but definitely at least package source and MAC ports should technically have been all people needed, right? But for whatever reason, some group decided there needed to be a reinvention of that, and it results in brew, and it's getting pull requests for new recipes, or I think they call them, what do they call them, bottles or brews or something like that. So, it's getting these, it's getting activity, it's getting support from a community that I guess built itself from out of nothing. I don't know where it all came from, but there it is. It's popular, it's big, it's important, it's noticeable. Same goes for chocolatey, chocolatey. It's there. People are using it. It's getting a lot of contribution. It's something that people can install and use and benefit from right now. And if you look at that, what that actually says, that means that of four major operating systems on this planet, all four of them have package management systems. Well, I could stop there. I mean, they have package management systems. And furthermore, those package management systems can trace their inspiration or their roots back to Unix. I mean, I'm not clear on how we want to measure the port system in BSD and the apps system in Debian and which came first. I mean, obviously the port system did. Was it in a state that was sort of had apt ease of use at that point? I don't know. I wasn't using it back then, so I have no opinion or insight into that. So leaving aside sort of like, well, who gets to claim the kernel of this idea, whether it's the BSD folk or Ian Murdoch himself, I don't know, and I don't care, it doesn't matter. I think the point is that the concept is a thing born of the open source software movement, and that's exciting because that concept, which arguably has been a source of much contention even within Linux itself, right? I mean, I've talked about package management and how it actually doesn't, like this sort of centralized package manager thing, it doesn't necessarily make sense in today's open source world, right? Because you've got so many sources of different open source packages, and you're expecting somehow for them to all sort of coalesce into a centralized repository. Not so sure that that's a realistic expectation for everybody. I mean, there needs to be some other system, such as Flatpak or Snap or whatever we're using. But the concept of this of the complete OS, and I'm doing that sort of in air quotes, that complete OS, whether you want to install it or not, the source media for your operating system living out there in the world on a server somewhere, and you are able to cherry pick the parts of it that you actually do want on your computer locally. That's a huge, huge thing. It's one of those things where the recognition of the network being sort of the adjunct to your computer, it's huge. And the recognition of there being an idea of, well, this is the OS, and it is managed by lots of different people, and the concept of a third party is more of something that you look at in degrees rather than, well, if it's not by this one entity, then it's a third party app. And instead, you look at applications in terms of, well, what did I install when I downloaded the ISO? And what have I added to it since then? And what do I need in the case of system failure and recovery? What do I need to layer back over my install? What's recoverable quickly? What will get me back up and running the fastest? That benefit of a package. Oh, and not to mention the developer angle of all of this. What libraries does my program that I'm making right now, what libraries does it rely upon? What does it need to have available to it? And since those are, since these are libraries that are important, let me grab the latest version and make sure that I have that on my development machine. And let me track what I've installed. And when I'm finished, let me dump everything out into a text file so I know all of my requirements and so on. This is all really, really important. And, or rather, it's beneficial to a lot of different people. It's beneficial to users. It's beneficial to developers. beneficial to just the ecosystem of an operating system. And it's been contentious. It's been something where people say, oh, Linux, you can't even install software like on a normal computer, a quote, normal computer on Linux. For 20 years, we've had to put up with that kind of critique. And now, what do you know? The two most major operating systems that most of the planet knows exist, they have, not officially, but they have, as I like to say, officially, unofficially, adopted these methods of implementing what Linux has been doing, Linux and BSD have been doing for years, for decades. And that is something that I feel as open source users and sort of contributors in whatever way we contribute, we should be really, really proud of that. Because it's easy to feel a little bit slighted by it. I mean, it's super easy to feel a little bit unimpressed, right? You see people championing this package management system on Mac OS or something, and you think, well, that's great that you have that. It's great that you can finally easily update from the Python 2.75 that your operating system still ships with to Python 3 with one command. It's really cool that you can update your whole stack of extra libraries and stuff with one command. But we've been doing that for 20 years already, and we've said that that's how things need to happen for development, but no one listened to us, and now you think this is the greatest invention. It's super easy to feel a little bit, I don't know, threatened slash, not, what was, I don't know, what's the opposite of jealous? Maybe possessive, you know, like, sort of like, well, this was our thing. You didn't like it before. Why are you using it now, talking about it like it's just normal? Like, where's the apology that we're owed? Well, in the real world, I don't think that really happens so much. You don't really get the formal apology, I think, is what we're learning largely from, for instance, Microsoft. You just don't really get that. What you get instead is imitation. And as everyone knows, as the very famous saying goes, imitation is the highest form of flattery. And that's what we're seeing here in a lot of different ways. You can look at, for instance, Microsoft, or any other company that you want to pick on. You can look at them and say, well, they're suddenly embracing open source because it's going to benefit them at some point. And obviously, you know, you're not wrong. Maybe there's a counter argument to that. Maybe if we said that, we're not being fair to some, you know, there's some angle in there that we're not necessarily addressing. But all of that aside, the thing that we can concentrate on and really, really take away from it is that they are into open source. They've come around to open source. They aren't open source. I mean, not yet. Not until Microsoft answers the Free Software Foundation's request that they open source Windows 7, which is end of life now, and Free Software Foundation, you can look this up, they actually launched a campaign requesting that Microsoft open sources Windows 7, which I thought was a brilliant campaign. They had a little petition that you could sign. I meant to mention it on this show and kept forgetting when it was actually happening, but I think it still proves a point, right? Microsoft is not open source. I mean, even if they open source Windows 7, I think we could accurately argue that they are not open source. But either way, dealing with what we have right now, Microsoft is not open source. They are not an open source company by any means. They may have embraced open source in many ways, but I don't think anyone would say, yes, well, Microsoft is a very large open source company. They just wouldn't say that because there's so many obvious things that are not open source within Microsoft, like, you know, the operating system or the Office suite or the database, or, you know, just you can just go down the list, right? So they're embracing open source, which means essentially that they're contributing, they're mimicking, they're doing the thing that open source people do. They're imitating companies that are truly open source. They're imitating, they're looking for all the world like an open source company, someone who doesn't necessarily have too much scrutiny, doesn't look too closely at the licenses. They seem like an open source company. They run GitHub. I mean, GitHub is open source, right? That was sarcasm, just to clarify. So they're imitating this practice, this open source way of doing things. And that is no matter what, no matter how threatening it seems or how nefarious their motives we may suspect their motives are, they're still doing the open source thing. And that's a huge form of flattery, whether they say it or not, right? And they're not going to ever say it. They're not ever going to say, it seems that all those Linux hackers back in the 90s and the aughts were right all along, and we were wrong. They're never going to say that. We might like to hear that. That's one of those sort of, we want a public apology types of consternation things, where people are remain upset at some group because they never apologized. And there will continue to be things that Microsoft does that aren't enough, right? They've never apologized, and they haven't offered anything really without a catch. You could probably argue something, but I think the exFAT drivers that aren't drivers is a pretty good example of kind of the conditions of their open source contribution, by and large. But the point is that they're valid contributors to open source now. And that is a huge compliment to open source. It's a compliment to Linux. It's a compliment to you and me who are using open source right now and believe that open source is truly the correct answer. So we should accept that as a compliment. That's something that we should be open to. We should be eager to accept that kind of compliment because it's loud and clear, even if it's not explicit, if that makes any sense. Now, there's another aspect to this sort of thing, and I think that this is the one that Mac and Windows don't actually know that's happening. I don't believe that the creators of this of these operating systems fully understand exactly what I at least I hope they're allowing to sort of surface around them. And this could turn around and bite back. So this could be incorrect, but I feel like one of the side effects of this sort of these movements within the operating systems of Mac OS and Windows, I feel like a side effect of these movements that are sort of embracing and sort of really insisting upon a shell interface, a text shell interface, a command line, a terminal, whatever you want to call it. They're insisting on that kind of interface because someone out there, some people are saying, hey, look, this is actually a far more efficient and manageable way of doing this set of tasks. And certainly, there's not a package manager out there so far that is shipping from Mac or Windows that embraces that at all, right? You don't see a homebrew system inside of Mac OS off the shelf, at least not yet. You don't see packages signed and delivered by Apple or developer.apple or whatever. Same goes for Windows. You don't see, your PowerShell doesn't come to you with Chocolaty available to you out of the box. That's something that you have to go download and install yourself. And there's even a couple extra setups in there to relax the authentication or the permission aspect of PowerShell. So they haven't officially embraced it, but I feel like it is happening, whether they know it or not. And by that happening, I'm assuming and I'm hoping that they are normalizing the idea of a text-based interface. Because people who see at least someone in their life, if it's not themselves, then someone else near them, they see them using PowerShell or Terminal, and suddenly it doesn't seem quite so weird that a Linux user might be using a text interface, or that certain Linux distributions don't even boot to anything but a text interface. Like, I got an email from someone the other day, and it was saying that there were some complaints about how Slackware didn't boot to a GUI installer. And I got the impression that the complaint was interpreting that as an error. Like that was a mistake. Like the text console of Slackware was the fallback mode. Now, if you've ever used Slackware, and I have, you'll know that the only installer for Slackware is a text-based installer. So it's not a fallback mode. That's the installer. That's it. And this email was complaining that people would would think that, and furthermore that they would think that and not bother to sort of read the documentation and learn that, hey, this is a distribution of Linux and the default installer is text-based. Like, couldn't even be bothered to understand that that wasn't a mistake. And that was, you know, vaguely disappointing to this person who emailed me. And I kind of have to agree. I mean, it's really disappointing when you hear from people these complaints about something that you just think, well, if you can't even bother to do enough research to understand that that wasn't an error, then what hope is there really to communicate anything? I mean, even if you responded to an email from someone like that, you, like, there's no assurance that they're going to read your email explaining that that wasn't an error. You know, they're like, if you don't at least do that much, then it's practically like all bets are off, and that can be discouraging. And just the sort of the fear and kind of the frowning upon, well, this is a text-based interface, so it involves less functionality / less work that has gone into it. I think it's a pity that people view it that way. Now, as with all complaints, there's some little kernels of truth there, right? I mean, if someone has programmed something and has not bothered creating a graphical interface, there's a possibility that that program required less effort than when someone has programmed something to have a GUI interface, simply because the difference there is that with a GUI interface, you need to have these header files and these libraries, and if you leave those off, then you don't need those. So obviously some more effort went into creating header files and libraries that get used in one application and aren't used in another. So technically speaking, there's truth there, right? It's, yes, you're right. The programming took possibly less effort. Now, that's not entirely always true, because, for instance, FFmpeg, I imagine, is a pretty complex program, and I don't know that you could argue that FFmpeg with a GUI would be any more complex than FFmpeg. I've seen GUIs for FFmpeg. That was my first open source application that I was using, sort of knowing that it was open source, was an FFmpeg GUI, believe it or not. So they've existed, and I guess they represent effort, but in terms of functionality, there's nothing extra there. So yeah, I think there's an argument there. And I get what people are sort of sensing, that, well, if you only did a text interface, then you didn't go to the extra trouble of doing something that was not text interfaced, and therefore you have done less for me. I can see how that would be interpreted that way. And I'm hoping that by normalizing the text interface and saying, or by, I should say, renormalizing it, because it used to be normal. That's the great travesty of all this, is that computers used to be the text interface. Like, that was it. That was the whole computer. And the fact that people are having to sort of relearn that that's an okay way to interface with computers, and in fact, arguably is, in many cases, the better way, like the more efficient way, the purer way. And by pure, I don't mean some weird sort of like, well, this is what computing means to me. I mean, like, literally, you're typing in words that the computer is going to parse exactly for what they are. Whereas with a GUI, many times you're making selections from predetermined selections that are options that someone else has provided you, because that, in the mind of that person, is all you would ever want to do with that application. And that may not be true. And a lot of times a GUI doesn't really open up the things that you want to do, because there's just not a box for that. They didn't think to put a little tick mark for, yes, I'd like to use, I don't know, standard input as my random seed for this generative art that I'm about to create. Whereas if you do something weird like that in, I don't know, FFmpeg or something, you never know what'll happen. So there you go. The text interface can be a powerful thing. You and I know that, dear listener. Other people, I think, are starting to warm up to that idea, or will warm up to that idea now that Homebrew and Chocolaty and other things out there exist that are telling people, just kind of by existing, that text interface idea wasn't such a bad idea. It's not such a scary thing. It may be foreign, it might be confusing at first, but the fact that it's a text interface is not the weird thing. that's okay. That can be a normal interface as well. So not only are Mac and Windows accidentally complementing open source by mimicking and taking plays right out of the playbook of open source and contributing back to open source because they have to, but they are also helping us as open source people, I think indirectly, they're helping us, they're lending voice to our explanation that computers ought to serve the user. Now they're doing their darndest to convince people otherwise. Like the actual operating systems, don't take my, I don't want you to take this positive spin on this thing as if to say Mac and Windows are now on our side or are even helping us along. I'm saying because these open source projects exist within those operating systems, or rather within those sort of spheres of influence, that is lending voice to open source. Mac and Windows themselves, however, are doing their darndest to reverse that control as usual, right? You're not getting any more actual control over what happens on your computer just because you happen to be typing stuff into a terminal. You're getting more options and more choice, which is very open source centric, but that data and that the code that you're running is still closed off from you. You cannot see that code. You can go to opensource.apple.com or whatever, open.apple.com, whatever it is. You can see what kind of source code they do offer you, and I guarantee you, most of it is completely not even their code, and then the code that is not very substantial. You'll be sorely disappointed, I think. Windows, I don't even know. I don't even think you can do that much. So the operating systems themselves are still closed and still very anti-user friendly. And by user friendly, I obviously mean more like your data and your privacy and so on. They are what they are. But these open source projects exist within them, in spite of them, and because the users are actually crying out for it. They're saying, look, we want this functionality. And they're getting it. Would those same users be better off switching to Linux? Absolutely. I have no question in my mind, they would be better off switching to elementary OS or something like that and just getting off of that train. But they're not doing that, but they are using open source, and that's a powerful thing. And we should take it as a compliment, we should take it as a good thing, and we should take it as an opportunity to point out that, Linux offers a lot of those things on a different and open platform. You should give it a try. Okay, that's it for the show at this time. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Congratulations, you are the grand prize winner in a nationwide contest.
Oh, I never won anything.
Well, you're out of now.